Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Sarah.
I'm Liz.
And this is the It's Fine, I'm Fine podcast. Well, today we have a really interesting episode. Do you want to intro this?
No, go ahead.
Okay. You might be surprised, but we are speaking with Liz's mother, mm-hmm. Marsha Silverheight.
That's right.
And I know that from Facebook.
Oh, right.
No, actually, I just knew that. And, you know, she has a really interesting story. Liz's mom has gone through a lot, mm-hmm. a lot of trauma,
mm-hmm.
and she's here to tell the tale,
mm-hmm.
as you said on the podcast.
Yes.
And I think this is going to be a little different for our listeners, but yeah. I think it's important.
Yeah.
And,
Before we get into giving you a little bit more background on my mom, I know Sarah wanted to talk about the giveaway that we did.
Yeah. So you may have seen on our Instagram, we did a giveaway with Baloo and Sleep Club, which on Instagram is Join Sleep Club.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun. We partnered with them and we were able to give one lucky winner a weighted blanket, which mm-hmm. is really amazing. I have one and they're awesome. And they really help with anxiety. It kind of feels like someone's hugging you.
Definitely.
It's like a heavy blanket. And it really feels like someone's like wrapping their arms around you. And it's just really nice to have, you know, especially when you're lonely and it's a Sunday night. You have the Sunday scaries. Like, I know I'm going to be using mine later. And so we were really lucky to be able to partner with them. And then we also gave away sleep strips thanks to Sleep Club. So it was an awesome giveaway. And we chose a winner. And she is really, really excited. And yeah,
it was cool to be able to do a giveaway with products that made sense for us.
Yeah.
Because I mean, we always talk about anxiety and how important it is to go to therapy, which of course it is. But sometimes you just need a little product to help you get through.
Totally. And I think weighted blankets are unique because it's not like an escape from anything. It's a comforting.
It's very comforting.
Do you know what I mean? It's
yes.
not like you're escaping your anxiety. It's
totally.
Just kind of helping you feel comforted and safe.
Totally. I agree. It's sometimes anxiety makes me feel like out of my body,
mm-hmm.
Or very like, you know, jittery.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what weighted blankets are for. So, I mean, even though we already did the giveaway, I highly recommend people look into Baloo or just weighted blankets in general. They're awesome.
Yeah. Agreed. And we'll link their Instagram handles and Sleep Clubs as well. You all can check it out and see who we've been working with.
Definitely. All right, peak and pit.
Peak and pit. You want to go first?
Sure. My pit was just like the short week didn't feel like a short week. It felt like a very long week. There's just a lot going on. I felt like overstimulated and underperforming. Like, I feel like I couldn't get anything done. Pretty basic peak, but I don't know if anyone feels me on that. That was my pit. And then my peak would probably be, I went out to dinner last night, like outside, and it was so cold, but I just had such a good time. Like, I hadn't gone to a restaurant really at all because they're all closed in New York, but outdoor dining is a thing. So it was just nice. Nice to go out to dinner and treat myself to some good food and bevies.
My pit, I also had a pretty crazy short, quote unquote short week because it was really busy at work. But I think separately from that, my anxiety was like really at an all-time high this past week. Like, I think some things that I haven't really like my anxiety was winning this week. Mm. I feel like I haven't really let it win in a while. Like, I've really been good at fighting these like lies that it tells me. And I think in the last week, like, I was kind of just believing everything that was coming through my brain. Like, no one likes you. And like, you know, like just like all the things that I like have. Usually I've been having recently a better time or an easier time at fighting those thoughts. But I think in this last week, I was just like highly insecure, highly anxious and just like sad. But my peak was I have been eating more vegetables.
Ew.
And that is something I know this is like crazy because I'm 26 and everyone's like, you haven't really been eating your vegetables and you're 26. But the answer is no. I really have been not eating my vegetables for a long time. And I feel like I'm finally excited about eating well. Like it is, has taken me so long to get to this place, but I'm just like excited about good foods, and usually healthy foods have always turned me off.
Totally.
And now I'm like, I have this air fryer, which like I know is like the talk of the town right now, but I'm so excited to make vegetables in it like all the time. And I'm just looking forward to making good food, which is really exciting for me, really refreshing. And I'm my digestive system is starting to get better. Who knew? So yeah, that's my peak.
I love that for you.
Thank you.
I think having a colorful diet is the easiest way to start. That's what they say.
Yeah.
Okay. So first, before we get into anything, I do want to issue a couple of trigger warnings.
Yes.
We talk about pretty much everything under the sun that needs a trigger warning today.
Yeah.
Almost. The first being we do talk about homicide and violence. So I can imagine that that's not something that's super easy for a lot of people to hear. I think it's important that the story be told, but I want people to be fairly warned about it. We also talk about suicide, which we've spoken about on the podcast before. Again, triggering topic.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, we do talk about eating disorders. When I listen to this back, I'll make sure there's like nothing else we talked about. But yeah, yeah, those are the trigger warnings. This is a heavy episode, but it, I think, leaves on a note of hope. So we talked to my mom today. My mom is 53 years old. And I'm saying that, Mom. Sorry, I don't
care. She said it on the
episode. Oh, she did. Okay. Yeah. Because I, you know, it's important. And I think it's 2021. We need to stop being like ashamed of our age. I know it's easy.
Ageist.
It's easy for me to say, but so my mom from early on in her childhood went through a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. She talks about when she was 10 years old, her brother was 11 years older than her, and he died by suicide. And it was the 70s. So my mom talks a little bit about how that was like
taboo,
not really discussed, not understood. He was definitely mentally ill, but I don't think they even named bipolar disorder frequently yet. That's what, you know, the family has sort of come to the conclusion that he had bipolar disorder, probably among other things. So that was, you know, my mom's childhood. She talks a little bit about how she dealt with that, how her family dealt with that or didn't deal with that. And it did lead to some eating issues for her. And as I've spoken about on the podcast, you know, I had that issue too. And I just think it's interesting that that happened because it's nature versus nurture. It's both. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure there are things that I learned from being around my mom, but there is a genetic component to eating issues. And then when my mom was in her 30s, I was 4 years old in 2001, her dad, my grandfather, was murdered. Mm-hmm. And I've never spoken about that before publicly because it's like, I feel like it's sort of my mom's story to tell. And now that she feels comfortable telling it, I'm really more interested in talking about it. I think besides the fact that, you know, this is a podcast about mental health and resilience and even trauma sometimes, which my mom talks about, I think it's just like a really important story that needs to be heard because as you'll learn, there was never any like justice, quote unquote, closure. No one was ever convicted. No one, you know, no suspects ever went far enough in the system for anything to like happen. And in February, it'll be 20 years. So I think at this point, it's not that it's not emotional, but, you know, we've it's been so long that we're able to kind of talk about it sort of from a distance, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel as raw, obviously, as it once did. And I just think it's important for people to hear because, as we say in the episode, Sarah and I obviously talk about our anxiety and our depression. And while those feelings are so valid and part of our mission is making people understand that those are valid, there's also some things in life that happen that are so like ugly and so
unimaginable.
And my mom has gone through those things and she has lived to tell the tale. And I think it's a really important thing for people to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so thankful that my mom wanted to come on, that Sarah opened the podcast for us, because even though this is a topic that we talk about, this really is my mom and my story. So I feel really appreciative that you know, we opened that space for her and for me. And also, I guess I should say I'm an open book. So if people like have questions about this, I'm going to share, you know, more of the story. I know it's really interesting. I mean, my family always says this is like truly Law and Order SVU. Like,
yeah.
It's a really interesting story. It's a crazy story.
There's an article in the New York Times about it, which mm-hmm. Liz will share.
Yeah.
We'll share on our page, I guess.
Yeah, I'll share it. And ask me questions. You know, that's part of the reason I love my mom so much, and that I think hopefully I inherited this quality, is like, I really don't, I'm not uncomfortable talking about it at all. Like, I want to talk about it more because I think it's like, I just want people to, mm-hmm. you know, feel comfortable asking questions. So
there's one thing that we spoke about on the episode that I just wanted to clarify, because I think people might be confused. At one point we said that your brother might have not been able to be buried in a Jewish cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to explain why, because people probably don't know why.
By your brother, you mean my mom's brother, by the way.
What did I say?
I think you said your brother.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's okay.
Your mother's brother. So, you know, take of this what you will. I'm not, this is really no shame to the ultra Orthodox Jewish community, because I'm very close to that community in many ways. And I think highly of many of them.
Mm-hmm.
But in Jewish values, Jewish tradition, the single most important thing ever is life. Mm-hmm. In Judaism, we value life over anything.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if you were an ultra Orthodox Jew and you were faced with either keeping the laws or saving your life, you would always put your life first.
Right.
Or if someone was pregnant and, you know, on the Sabbath, you're not supposed to use electricity, but if you were pregnant and you had to go to the hospital on a Saturday, that comes before any of the Jewish laws. You do what you have to do to make sure your health is prioritized.
Right.
And because life is so valued, suicide, and this is unfortunate, but suicide is really looked down on. Like,
yeah.
it is so horrible, and it is so, like, it's seen as like the worst crime you could commit in the Jewish faith, because you're taking away something that is like the most important thing ever,
right?
Which is your life,
right?
And obviously, like, the point of our podcast is to normalize these conversations, because in order to help the suicide rates, like, ideally we would be more open about them and we would talk about them, because, you know, I know from first personal experience with myself, like, it is possible to get to a place where you don't want to be here anymore. And that's not because you think it's better. Like, I don't want to get too far down on this road, but, like, I know from firsthand experience that it's not because you don't value life.
Yeah.
It's because you actually think it would help everyone else.
Yeah.
You think it would, that you're a burden on everyone else, and you're helping everyone else by taking your own life.
I heard about it once. Suicide is like, it feels like you're in a burning building and you, I'm sorry for this is morbid, but then you jump out. Cause it's like,
which way
would you go? Do you want the pain to end? Or do you want to, like, live in hell? And I think that's the thing that people really don't understand. And I really appreciate the way you tactfully put that, because, as Sarah said, like, we have, especially you, like, we have ties and closeness with people in much more religious communities. And I do also think it's still really being, like, understood by everyone. Like, mm-hmm. we still really don't understand so much about suicide. And I think when you have any traditional sect of any, it's not just Judaism, but that's all we can speak to. You know, it's hard to understand.
Yeah.
And it's hard to justify, because if you are someone who has never had depression, you're kind of like,
Why would someone do that?
It's weakness.
It's selfish.
It's selfish.
Yeah.
And
which is so sad.
It's so sad.
So not selfish.
And, you know, it was also the 70s when it happened. So, you know, take that plus my mom being raised in a pretty religious community. And it was, you know, she talks about she couldn't really talk about it.
Yeah.
She had to kind of make things up. But I'm glad that we're saying that, because I think if we came on here and said, you know, that's bad, and everyone who doesn't believe in this stuff is bad, and we should all be champions for this, we would be being unrealistic. Like, we need to approach this problem with a sense of reality, because there's people in the world who think about this differently than we do.
Yeah.
And in order for us to all heal, I think there needs to be a sense of openness about, like, why is it that people feel that way? And I think Sarah explained it so well.
Yeah. Cause I don't want anyone to take this away, like, those were the bad people.
Yeah.
Because as we all know, like, when you're taught something at a young age, you're taught that suicide is one of the worst things that you can do, without understanding the mental health part of it.
Right.
You really don't understand why someone would ever do that. I just want to make it clear that, you know, so there's so many people out there that just don't understand.
Yes. And there's so much nuance to this issue. And if we came out here and said everyone who doesn't understand suicide is an evil or whatever.
Exactly. Because
they're thinking is not evil. They're thinking, you know,
it's like for the best.
Right. When you grow up amongst such a different mentality than even Sarah and I have, it's hard to explain it.
Yeah.
It's hard to understand it. It's not the same way me and Sarah speak about depression and suicide. So I appreciate that we're able to talk about this in a way that's like not judgmental in on either side.
Right.
Like coming from a place of like, how can we
like
heal this
others.
And understand it as opposed to being, as opposed to passing some sort of judgment. Yeah. And I also do want to clarify, we tried to clarify a little bit when my mom was speaking, but my mom and her dad had kind of a tense relationship toward the end of his life. My mom and my dad got divorced a little bit before my grandfather passed away. And as my mom explains, like my grandfather was very traditional and like his philosophy, even though he was a great person, but as everyone knows, you know, life isn't black and white. Mm-hmm. There's people who are great people and they treat people they love not so great. So when my mom divorced my dad, my grandfather was really not happy about it. You know, his philosophy was like, you know, he doesn't hurt you. He doesn't cheat on you. You stay. And so my mom and his relationship was kind of strained toward the end. And so when my mom talks about, at one point she says like, you know, my dad did some bad things. I want to clarify that that doesn't have anything to do with like his life and his business because
right.
he was murdered. So I want to clarify that we weren't, my mom wasn't implying like.
He was murdered because he did something bad.
Yes, exactly. Like really it's just a, you know, they had a strain on their relationship. And I think it was hard and it was hard for my mom to wrestle with. But I'm really happy that everyone's listening. I hope, as I said, ask me any questions. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add.
No, I'm just really appreciative.
Yeah,
of your mom and of you for sharing this story because it's not an easy one.
No.
But I think these conversations are really important, and you know, Liz and I, we really try to talk about heavy topics in a way that's like accessible to all types of people.
Right.
And easily digestible, but sometimes you just have to like talk about these really heavy things and there's no other way to say them but just like to say them.
Yeah.
So I mean,
I don't want to say enjoy. So this is the episode.
Yep.
Okay, mommy, we're recording.
Okay.
So why don't you, we're going to do this chronologically. Why don't you start us from the beginning? Can you tell us about your childhood?
About my childhood? Starting at the age that I remember, you mean?
Yeah. Like, I think we want to talk about Uncle Chucky. So if you could talk about like sort of life before that, because I know that it probably got drastically different after.
I don't, honestly, so there was a 10-year age gap. My brother was 10 years older than I was, and my mother had several pregnancies in between that didn't come to fruition. So I think I was kind of the oops baby, even though she never really said that. I don't have a lot of memories, like sitting at the dinner table, like normal memories I think that people have. I have they're sort of episodic, mm-hmm. kind of like they're incidences that I remember. And none of it was really good stuff. But that was my family life. But my childhood was, I was kept very, very separate. Because he was so much older and he was always in treatment. He was, I mean, I don't know if
your brother, this is Chucky.
My brother. Yes. He was, in the early 70s, they didn't have names for bipolar disorder mm-hmm. or schizophrenia. So everybody was diagnosed with a chemical imbalance. And I don't even know if he had, you know, if they had the medication for it or if they did what it was. And I don't have any point of reference anymore. I don't even think that there is no point of reference. I don't even think that my mother probably knew or my dad. So my childhood was wonderful. I mean, just, you know, me, because it was really only me in the house.
Right.
That mm-hmm. I remember, you know, most of the time. So I had friends. I went to Jewish day school in New York. I went to summer camp in the Berkshires, like my daughter, but for 10 summers, I mean, it saved my life. It was very important for my father, who was very emotionally distant, but it was very important for my father to get me out of the house over the summers. So I think that's when a lot of the bad stuff was happening. Because I started...
What bad stuff? Like with your brother?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were periods that I know that my brother had slept on a bench in Washington Square Park. He didn't like come home for 2 days. But then again, a lot of this may be lore, you know, it's kind of like, I don't
know. Well, in your opinion, because I know you're not a professional and you weren't old enough, but like if you could kind of assess what you think was going on with him, do you think it was like bipolar schizophrenia?
I think that he was probably bipolar. Just,
okay.
You know, the way that he was behaving and the fact that he was self-medicating with drugs and then with alcohol. You know, when people are mentally ill, what I have discovered and what I've come to learn from my own experience with therapy and what I've read is that, you know, it's drugs and or alcohol. It's anything that will medicate you, that will calm you down.
Right.
You know? That's my general assessment. But I like, there's nobody to ask, and I don't even think that they would know.
Right.
So that was my, I went away to camp when I was 7. I turned 8 at camp.
Can you believe that she went when she was 7?
That is crazy. I mean, yeah. I know a lot of people who did, but
so young.
And I still wasn't the youngest one there. There was a 5-year-old there.
That's crazy. And you would go for 2 months?
Yeah.
Wow. What was your relationship like with your brother? Were you guys close when he was home? Did you speak? Did you ever connect with him?
I adore him and vice versa. I mean, I have some photographs. They're just so loving. You can tell just from, you know, the picture's worth 1,000 words. They're just like, I adored him.
Did you know what was going on with him?
Not until I was older, not until I was in high school. Mm-hmm. Because he just wasn't around a lot.
Mm-hmm. Where was he though?
He was in and out of mental health facilities. He's at Bellevue for a while. And he just wasn't around. So I can't even, he actually went to Stuyvesant High School and he moved ahead of grade. I mean, he had, you know, such incredible.
Really smart.
Yeah.
Oh. And then what happened? Cause our listeners don't know.
He had just turned 21. We had taken him up to a place in Vermont. I can't remember the name of the town right now. It was almost like a communal health kind of place, kind of like it was almost like a kibbutz or a moshav where you worked the land and you did, you know, mm-hmm. you participated in activities but they had everybody that you needed on staff. They had social workers. They had physicians. Mm-hmm. And we took him up, I don't remember, sometime in the fall, I think.
You went with them? You went with Nan and Papa? Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah, we all went up. And we met his specific counselor, and I remember seeing the room he was going to be in, and my parents went just themselves over Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
But I just know that Thanksgiving was a holiday. My mother never, it was something that was so big in my house, and it was so multicultural,
mm-hmm.
but it just stopped after my brother committed suicide. And I was home on winter break in December, and I think it was December 29th, but I'm not entirely sure, but it was right before New Year's Eve. And the phone rang, and it was him, and my bedroom was right next to my parents, and I remember my mother making the bed, and I just heard her like kind of very loudly saying, you know what, Chucky, we made, his name is Charles, but we called him Chucky. Chucky, you know, we made an agreement, you would stay until at least Passover. You know, sometime in April. And he's like, Mom, I don't belong here. This was according to my mother. I don't belong here with all of these people who are so sick. I'm not this sick.
Hmm.
And I don't know the time frame, but then the next phone call we got, my mother picked it up in the kitchen. Do you remember? You're so young.
I remember the kitchen.
No, but we had a kitchen, but the phone was on the wall in the kitchen.
Right.
And you could actually pull out the cord. And so she walked into the dining room with the phone. I just remember her screaming.
Yeah.
And dropping the phone. And my grandmother was living with us, my mom's mom at the time. And she was living in another room, and we both came out at the same time. And she just said, you know, that, you know, your brother just killed himself. That was it. And I didn't ask her how. I didn't find out how from her. It was one of those things that I didn't want to upset her anymore. Then she had
your mom, that is. You didn't want to ask Nana.
Yes, your Nana. Yeah, I didn't want to ask my mom. So I actually had a therapist give me a book called The Parentified Child, mm-hmm. where like I took on the role of sort of being somewhat of a parent because my dad just, he checked out.
Mm-hmm.
He just checked out. He couldn't deal with it. I mean, you know, so, you know, I took on a lot of that emotional responsibility with my mother. And she didn't talk a lot about my brother, but she talked about him. But my father just wanted to sort of you know, put it away.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very much a generational thing.
Yeah.
And it's sad because what my therapist also told me was that secrets keep you sick. You know, that's why I wanted to tell my story and why I am very, there's nobody left that I have to worry about embarrassing anymore. Right. You know what? And that was a big deal for me. It was like, I just didn't tell people. And I don't, there are times when I tell people when I get very sad and upset. And then there are times when I can just say matter of factly, this is what happened. I mean, this is part of the fabric of who I am. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of want to scream it from the rooftop sometimes so that people don't ignore certain signs and that people know that they, it has to be a family project.
Right.
Right. I think at the time, I assume that suicide was very taboo. Like no one spoke about it and families just kept those types of things hush hush. Just, we don't want like a strain on whether it's the family name or right. whatever it is. So, I mean, so your father, what did you see him cry or what was his reaction?
Father, was an attorney. He had an office in Manhattan and he came, I remember him coming home. And they were sitting in the bedroom and he was sitting in a chair and I he said, come up, sit on my lap. So I did. And I could tell that he had been crying, but I didn't see him actually cry. It was just, and then it was just autopilot after that. So,
well, we didn't touch on how you grew up in a pretty religious, not household, but like neighborhood. My mom grew up, for those who don't know what this is, in Borough Park, which is now, it's in Brooklyn. And it's a neighborhood that's entirely comprised now of ultra-Orthodox Jews, not Orthodox Jews, ultra-Orthodox. And when my mom lived there, it was, there were a lot of, like, how would you have described it when you lived there? Was it?
It was still very, very Orthodox. So, I grew up in the same house. This could explain so much. I grew up in the same house that my father grew up in, which, wow. You know. It's funny because when I tell people that I'm from Brooklyn, they think it's so cool. They think I'm like from Park Slope or Brooklyn.
Right, right. Like Williamsburg as it is today. But even back then, Williamsburg was pretty like Borough Park, very Jewish. And that, did that affect the funeral and the did you feel like it was kind of taboo in the community that you had a brother who killed himself?
I wasn't allowed to tell anybody at school. And I think the story was that like he fell off the back of like a truck because it was in the country and whatever, but I they wanted me to make something up.
Wow.
And you think about it now, that's just so messed up. But I didn't go to the funeral. My mother gave me the option, and which I think was probably a very smart thing on her part. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it's not like it was a grandparent, you know, right. that it happened in a normal, you know, somebody was old and it was just sort of that they lived the whole course of their life.
Yeah. Right.
I think now that like, if I had seen my mother out of that funeral, it would have been more indelible than it already is.
Right.
You know, so, I stayed with some family friends with their kids, mm-hmm. the older kids, because their parents had gone to the funeral. But, I mean, you know, and then I just remember the Shiva, it was like, it was just nuts. And he was buried in a Jewish cemetery. Somehow my dad fixed that up because you're not supposed to be if you're Jewish and you commit suicide. So,
you had talked about camp and you still went to camp, I think until what, you were like 16, 17.
I went straight through. I was a counselor. Yeah.
Right. So I know also that, and this is something I've talked about on the podcast with Sarah and with everyone, is that I had a lot of troubles with eating. And I remember telling you that I was having, you know, I was sick when I was like 17, and you told me the story about you coming home to see Nana and pop up from camp when you were like 15, and maybe you were younger. Why are your eyes wide open like that?
Because I can't believe that
you told me, and I never forgot that, you came home and you had lost a lot of weight, I guess, at camp or whatever. And Nana, so that's my grandmother, my mom's mom, her reaction was like, what did I do? And I never forgot that you had this fairly similar experience to me, which it's obviously both genetic and like just learned.
Like nature and nurture.
It's nature and nurture. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting and sad that there's this sort of lingering, like, generational trauma, sort of. I don't really have a question, but I wanted to share that tidbit that when I came to you and spoke to you about it, I didn't know that you had gone through that too. And now in hindsight, just like reviewing my childhood, I can pinpoint a lot of times, I think, and I don't mean this in a judgmental way, but that both of us probably didn't have great relationships with food.
No, and what a narcissistic thing for my mother to say. And she wasn't a narcissist, but, like, you know, she just immediately, it was this self-blame thing. And I'm like, all I wanted to do, all daddy and I wanted to do for you was just make sure you were okay.
Mm-hmm. You and my dad. Yeah.
It's to just make sure you were okay.
Right.
Like, I wasn't blaming anybody, you know, it's just, we know that it's a way of managing and controlling things when you feel that things are out of control.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And certainly things in my family were,
right.
And I probably felt the same way. And camp was easy for it to start because I would sneak out, or when the kids, if I didn't, wasn't teaching, I taught tennis, you know, if I didn't have a period to teach tennis, I would sneak and I would just sneak the kids food, you know, I mean, all the snacks that they'd gotten. And then I would throw up. So that's how it started.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, bulimia, anorexia, they kind of cross over at different points.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that was my mother's reaction. It was really weird.
I think that that's also, though, another case of just how people reacted to it back then. She wouldn't have understood it. I'm not removing blame, but
no, she wouldn't have understood it.
Right.
No. Right. And I don't think she could deal with it after everything else that happened. You know, it was kind of like, you know, more shit I have to, you know, really.
Right. And maybe, I mean, this is an assumption, so please correct me if I'm wrong. But so would you, just to be clear, the eating issue started after your brother's death.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
So what I'm assuming is that your parents probably felt some type of guilt when he passed, and then maybe seeing you in a state that wasn't, like, you were underweight, she probably also felt guilt,
mm-hmm.
right?
Is that
safe to assume?
Yeah.
I'm just, like, thinking about how she must have felt when you came home and maybe you were underweight and she was like, oh my gosh, like,
right.
What is my issue?
How did I make this mistake again?
Yeah, like, what am I doing again?
Right.
Type of thing.
And I'm sure that my father felt the same way, but he just wasn't able to express
right.
it. So, but he was, I mean, I, you know, I, well, you don't know, but I adored my father. I mean, I loved both of them so much. And so much of who I am is, I'm a lot like my mother. Lizzie's a lot like me. I'd like to think in the good ways. I'm probably in the bad ways too, but you know, I have a strong personality. I have very strong opinions. I'm not uncomfortable around, you know, I pretty much can talk to most anybody. And I think Elizabeth is the same mm-hmm. way. And she's very empathetic. But I adored them. And my father just, you know, I was like the apple of his eye.
Mm-hmm.
So for somebody who was very emotionally removed, he was my daddy.
Right.
You know, if I ever had a problem or anything that I needed, you know, like I said, he was the one that made sure I went away to camp.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the director came over and we did this same thing with you when you went to
I
camp,
remember.
The director came over.
Yeah.
And she had a slideshow, and I remember walking out of the house, and my mother was hysterical crying already, you know, just with a pitch.
Yeah.
And my father just looked at my mother and said, oh, she's going. She's going. She needs to go. It's where she needs to be, kind of mm-hmm. thing. So,
and then I don't want to talk too much about your divorces, just for people's knowledge of the timeline. My mom and dad had me in 1996. I'm 24. And then you got divorced in 2000,
1999? By 1999,
okay.
We were separated.
And my mom and dad, actually, just a fun fact, knew each other since you were what, like eight?
Well, we went to elementary school
right.
together. I was at his
wow.
grandfather.
Yeah. So then in 2001, you had been divorced from dad for, I don't know, a year. And can you tell me sort of what happened with Pop-Up? Oh, also you should mention, like, Nana was sick at this point. She wasn't.
Yeah, she was not really able to take care of herself. And we lived on the second floor of a three-family house. And so she was homebound. So my father had left the office in Manhattan and moved to an office in Brooklyn, which was a storefront, basically, about four blocks away, so he could come home and make sure she took her medication and feed her lunch.
What did she
have? She had rheumatic fever as a child. She probably didn't finish her course of antibiotics. And what rheumatic fever will do is it will ultimately affect your heart. So she had a heart condition and she had several mini strokes because of the heart condition. And, she'd had open heart surgery. And I think that it was the mini strokes that really caught, like it sort of just went downhill. Mm-hmm.
So this is 2001.
Yeah.
He moved February. His office to Brooklyn. He was a lawyer.
Yeah, because I think he had wanted to be there closer to her.
Right. And at this point, you're separated.
From daddy.
Yes.
And she lives in Philadelphia.
Liz's dad was, he was there through the whole mm-hmm. thing with me. You know, he was definitely, we were not married anymore. But he was a huge support system for me because he adored my parents.
And they adored him. It's February in 2001. And what happens?
I got a phone call, I think on a Tuesday morning, that at about 5 a.m. and you were with daddy. You were with me.
So
you
for
were with daddy.
Context, I was 5 years old at this point. I was four. I wasn't even five yet.
No, you were four when my father died. And, my father's first cousin lived downstairs from
Barbara,
us.
Right?
I mean, that it's Barbara, right? And she was the one who made the phone call. She said, you know, and I could hear her I could hear that she'd been upset, but she said, daddy didn't come home last night. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean he didn't come home? He did not come home last night. And I said, okay. And now then everybody sort of sprung into action. My mom got on the phone and I said, okay, you know, I'm coming. And Jeff, Lizzie's dad, took Lizzie and just, you know, make sure that, you know, I was like, I have to go back to Brooklyn. And the interesting thing was that this is the kind of sheltered life that I led, was that I had never done that drive by myself because Jeff had always done it. And so I'd never driven on the turnpike. So every time, so my father was missing for 5 days. I went back every day, but every time I went, I took somebody different with me because I didn't want my friends, I didn't want to drive them crazy, but it was like sitting vigil. Right. Because we had no idea where he was. I mean, his first cousin, along with Barbara, was a Supreme Court justice. So he called in all the rank and file. He'd had the pull to get all the hospitals checked because we thought, you know, maybe he just, you know, maybe he hit his head somewhere and he's in a hospital and he didn't have ID on him, you know. So that those were the original thoughts, and he was a missing person at first. And And Jeff, I mean, Lizzie's dad and I went, he's very instrumental in all this because he was so much a part of it. We went back to Brooklyn about before they had found him. We were going to go to the local precinct, and they said and I called them and asked them, and they said, that's a good thing because if you weren't coming to us, we were coming to you. I wasn't there when the local precinct came to talk to my mom, but Jeff and I went to the precinct to send it, and it, you know, you have to be missing, I guess, for what, 24 or 48 hours before, you know, it becomes, you know, suspicious circumstances. You're considered a missing person. And, after that, I don't know when, but, homicide took over. I'm not really sure why they assumed that. Intermediate period when he was missing. I don't know who was sort of running, the case, but it was not the local precinct.
Well, didn't they go to his office?
Well, my cousin went to his office with my cousin had a key. They owned the property together. This was my cousin, the judge, and he unlocked the office and he went in with the police, and they found. And like I said, it was a storefront. And here's this thing too, is that you had to be buzzed in because there were a lot of weird people, I mean, that would come in. So my father said, you know what, I'm just going to put it on buzzer. So somebody either followed him in, pushed him in, or he knew them and let them in. But there was apparently one of the detectives told me there was a lot of blood all over the office, like, and it was splattered in a way that it looks like he had been, you know, hit several times just because of the pattern. And his car was still there. It was snowing, and his car was still in front of the office. So they took him. And when they found him on Saturday, so this was a Tuesday, they found him on Saturday in a shallow grave because it was very cold. And it was the people who killed my father, they had wrapped him in tarp. This is what I heard from the detectives. And they tried to bury him. And it was a known sort of place to, like, dump bodies right near the Verrazano Bridge. Yeah, it was Coney Island. Yeah, it was. Well, that was the precinct that took over. So it was, like, sort of near Coney Island. And I think that it was a jogger who found him.
That's like Law and Order.
It's a Lifetime movie. I mean, everything. One of my oldest friends from camp, who I'd known since I was 8, she drove back with me that Saturday. And
you didn't want to stay there. I remember that part of the story. You were very toxic and scary. So you would drive from Philadelphia to Brooklyn every single day.
And what would happen in Brooklyn? Just waiting to see if he would show up?
Yeah. We sat around the dining room table and it was just kind of waiting to see what was happening. There were news crews in front of the house. And there were reporters coming by all the time. But I couldn't stay. I wasn't staying in that house. I had to come back to Philadelphia. My friends were there. That was my home. And it was.
And they didn't check the office for the first 5 days?
No, they checked the office. I don't know at what point after that Tuesday, probably Wednesday. Because I think my mother just immediately called my dad's cousin, because he was sort of like, you know, the person that would manage the family kind of. And my dad and his first cousin were very, very close. They were both only children. And so he was sort of called in to sort of take charge. And he really did take charge.
I was going to say, I know that it's probably like a little murky, because I can imagine that that period of time was sort of like fight or flight. Like you weren't really operating with a lot of.
Like at 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, do you remember?
Exactly the verbiage. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that was exactly the verbiage I was thinking of today. It was fight or flight. Exactly the way that I felt. So, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Remember, did you guys think that he had been killed? I mean, if you knew that the office had blood and he wasn't coming back, like, were there conversations about like, okay, now we just wait for, you know, them to find a body or some police officer to come? Like, do you remember what was the conversation like on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday?
Well, to be frank, my cousin, my father's cousin, the judge, had sort of taken over everything in my house. I mean, he was answering the phone. He was going through my father's things. And I was just getting a bad vibe, like just a bad vibe. And I talked to the detectives and they didn't want me to. I said, this is my dad.
Who didn't want you to?
What? The cousin, the judge didn't want me.
Let's give him a fake name. Joe.
Yeah, didn't want me talking to the detectives. Like, he wanted to handle everything. You know, I went estranged from my father. So because, you know, and we had our share of problems because of my divorce from Liz's dad, but it was just warming up. But there was a period when we didn't speak.
You and Joe?
No, my dad and my mom and me, we didn't speak because they were very angry because, you know, my dad's attitude was, you know, he doesn't beat you. He doesn't cheat on you.
Like, why would
he
you get divorced?
Drink, you know, why would you just leave him? You know, you don't do that. Detectives told me that there was a substantial amount of blood in the office. And Joe basically said, who told you that? He used to talk like that. Who told you that? I said, the detectives. There wasn't that much blood. I said, really? They made it very clear that he was killed in the office. And at that point, you know, my timeline's kind of sketchy. Like, I can't remember how many of these conversations happened when we were, you know, sitting vigil or when we were sitting shiva. I mean, it's all sort of, they all sort of blend together. Yeah. I mean, I at a certain point, I realized that it's hard to talk about without getting into sort of the criminal aspect of it and what mm-hmm. my thoughts are about what happened, because my father was a real estate attorney.
Right.
And he was a solo practitioner. He was not,
he wasn't working with the mob. He wasn't working on big cases.
No. And nobody unsavory. If he thought like he was, and this was also part of the issue. He was so angry with me, with his dad, was that he was straight as an arrow.
Right. He was extremely moral.
Clean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With, for me, but believe me, my parents had friends who had gotten divorced, and that was
but
okay.
We're saying he was extremely by the book, like he didn't do anything out of the ordinary. The people that he helped were like immigrants or people who lived in Brooklyn, a lot of religious Jewish people. And there's an article that I'll share, if you don't mind me sharing, the New York Times article that basically tells this story, because obviously it was a murder. And so the New York Times wrote about it in 2001. And the way that, you know, they sort of described Pop-Up was just, he had this routine. And so when he didn't come home to take care of Nana, it was, first of all, obvious immediately that there was something
that
amiss.
Had happened to him, as opposed to
like
a mistake he made.
Right. And it makes the story much more interesting, because it's like, well, you know, if he had been working with, if he had been a criminal defense attorney or a prosecutor, you know, this would have been more easy to understand. So I don't want to speak for you, but to give people context, that we're now sitting 20 years later and there has been no conviction around this. There's been no...
it's still a mystery who did it.
Right.
Wow.
Well, homicides
are never closed,
but
we as a family, there was never no
justice,
suspect, no suspect that went anywhere far in the system. There was never a trial. Nobody. Like, we don't have a definitive answer that the NYPD put on a piece of paper that says who killed Pop-Up.
No, there were people that were interviewed, but I'm not entirely sure who they were. They there are several theories. Could have been a real estate deal gone bad. You know, and like I said, I have my own theories. But I just find it very odd that, and I know a lot, I watch a lot of like
crime shows.
PD. I mean, I've always liked them, you know, orders. I just find it really hard to believe that there was no evidence. There was no trace.
I was going to say, because I think a lot of people who are listening would probably start asking, like, did they do a DNA test from anything they found in the office? Like, were there fingerprints left over, you know?
I don't know. And if they did, they didn't find anything that they felt was, you know, that would help.
Because you would think that if they found blood, the people weren't really trying to clean it up.
Right.
I just meant like they didn't try and clean up the office. So like maybe a fingerprint would have been left over.
Right. Or right. There was plenty of evidence.
There was evidence. Right. Like it was a crime scene that they could have looked into. But maybe, I don't know.
It got cut off at a certain point is how I understand it.
Fully.
It hit like a stop point, and you and Nana never really got definitive answers about, like, you know, who did this.
No, they've never, it just remains unsolved, and it's been sitting on, you know, in a box on a shelf since 2001.
So I want to hear before I have other questions, you were on your way back from Brooklyn to Philadelphia on Saturday with Tanta Leslie, my mom's really close friend, when you got the phone call.
Exit 7 on the New Jersey Turnpike. I will never forget it. So she pulled in to the rest stop, but she said, "Do you want
wait,
to turn
no,
around
you have
back?
To who called you? Like who told you?"
My mom. Oh my God, I just said mommy. My mom called. Lizzie calls me mommy. Isn't that funny? My mom called and said they found daddy's body. I'm sorry, I thought that I had said that already, but I guess we kind of got sidetracked a little bit. And that's when Leslie said to me, "Do you want to go back?" And I said, "No, what? There's nothing for me to do. I mean, I was speechless, because that meant that there were detectives that came to the house, just like you see on TV, and told my mother that they'd found him. And it's a horrible thing to say, but I am so glad that I wasn't there for that, you know, and that my mother had to experience that. Part of me wishes I had been there for her, but, I came back to Philadelphia, and my friends, I had told my friends, I had called some of them, and they came over and sort of just to hang out for a while. But yeah, that's what happened. I mean, the whole office thing was just very, that whole thing was very weird.
Suspicious.
It was very, very
weird. And I was four. So like from my perspective, I remember Pop-Up. Like, I know you know that, but I remember him. He was, I saw him all the time. Like one of the reasons you didn't drive on the turnpike was because Pop-Up always came to pick me up and took me back to New York. And one of the most terrible things about him not being here, about any grandparent not being here, is he never met Charlotte, which is so crazy to me. And it's just, I was so young, but I really distinctly remember going to the Shiva, because I didn't go to the funeral. I didn't even go to Nana's funeral, because I remember just like Nana gave you the option. You gave me the option when Nana died. You said, do you want to go? And I said, no. I was 9. I don't know if you remember that. But I remember my dad holding me at Nana and Pop-Up's house at the Shiva. And I remember saying, well, where's Pop-Up? Like, I really didn't understand what was going on. And then I remember being maybe 8. So at this point, my Nana died. My mom's mom died when I was 9. So probably she died in 2005, 4 years after Pop-Up. And she,
like, naturally? Sickness?
She was sick. And then this is just my perspective. But I know that after, you know, your brother died, she was never, she, I can't imagine she ever returned back to who she was before that. Like in 1977 or whatever that year was, it was probably a lot of time of her mentally deteriorating and physically, as you said, like she started to get sick in her 50s, physically sick. And then my memory of her from age 4 to 9, so after Pop-Up died and before she died, was she had dementia and she was physically sick and she was very distraught. Like she was extremely loud. I remember going to see her with dad, my dad, who, as people have now learned, dad wasn't with you anymore. So dad would take me to see her when you didn't. And I remember her saying, you know, we have to figure out who did this. Like she was, of course, as anyone would be, upset, but it didn't make sense. Like she had just lost it, honestly.
You know, she wasn't very coherent. And I actually, she had an outburst, and I had you there, and I was very proud of myself for doing this. And it was about 9:30 at night. And I said, you know what, Mom? I Elizabeth can't hear this. She can't see you behave this way. We're leaving. And I just drove back to Philadelphia, you know, at night. I said, this is it. Sorry. You know, you're really screwed up, you know, and she was taking antidepressants and she was taking meds, but she had just lost it. And I just like, it's all she knew is that how she had lived in for 40 years.
I think that's the really, like unique part of this story is how, not that murder or like death ever makes sense, but how it really was like this pretty like traditional family. I want to say like, just, they weren't like, they were so routine oriented and like, Pop-Up took care of Nana, and Nana was like such a like wife in the sense that she was always being taken care of and things were paid for and like they doted over me. Like there was nothing unusual about your family. I mean, of course there was your brother, but just in terms of the way you lived your life every day, that all of a sudden it like everything shifted. And I think from my perspective, it seemed like Nana really just deteriorated after that. Like there was no sense of normalcy. She got a full-time nurse or at least a part-time nurse to live with her.
Yeah, I was going to say, Pop-Up
took care of her.
Did she live alone for the year?
No, I found the care. A next door neighbor stopped me and said, you know, I have a wonderful woman. And she was an Orthodox lady. She said, who took care of my mother. And she was this
Raisa.
Russian lady. And she was Raisa. She was fabulous. And then when my mother couldn't, well, she tweets, so because we lived on the second floor, we had steps. When she couldn't do the steps anymore at all, we moved. It was horrible. Charlotte's dad was with me when we moved my mother.
This is my mom's second husband, right. Not to use like those types of terms, but that's what he was.
And so we had to take her out from the house, the only house she'd ever known. And we moved her into the same apartment building that Raisa lived in. which was actually not that far, but it was just, it was just the strangest set of circumstances in just so many ways. Mm-hmm. So,
and also I'm sure that people might want to know like what, how I figured this out. And I remember you asking me once at Nana's apartment. So I must've been seven. If you said to me, like, do you know what happened to my dad? And I remember saying like somebody shot him, and you said, well, not quite, but sort of somebody hurt him and they killed him and he died. And, you know, I was probably 10 or 11 when I like found the article, because I was really curious about it. Obviously
you were like looking into it yourself.
Yeah, and I didn't really, I just like you did with your mom, I didn't really want to ask. So,
I couldn't ask because, you know why?
No, but I'm talking about you. I don't want that to hurt your feelings, but I didn't, you know, how do you talk about that with your mom?
And like Liz had a hard time asking you about
Papa,
your father's loss.
Right.
So, and I remember, you know, I think part of the reason we wanted to have you on the show, besides to tell this story, was to talk about how you dealt with it afterwards, because I think Sarah and I obviously talk all the time about like our anxiety, and not that that's nothing,
right?
Like we
like
really,
not to diminish
not
our
to diminish
anxiety
that or the people listening, but I think there are probably people listening who have had not this experience, but you know, terrible stuff happens to people, and you're here, and I know that it hasn't been easy since, but you're here to tell the tale, and I think that that's a really important lesson for people, not lesson, but story, because you then went on to have Charlotte and me, and not to brag, but like we're amazing. So, so you had, I'm just, my point is really like you
recovered from really intense trauma.
Right.
And you're here to tell us about it. And so how did you cope with it? And how are you today?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there's always one person who survives these kinds of things. And I guess it was just, you know, it was supposed to be me, but what I've learned is that everybody's got a story, and people forget that everybody's got, there's, everybody has texture. And I say this to Lizzie all the time. Everybody's got a story. Mm-hmm. We know nothing about, you know, if you see somebody, you know, that's that you're bringing up your groceries and they're in a crappy mood, like who knows what happened? Like, I think it's taught me to be much more, I'd like to say empathetic and understanding, and much more charitable, not necessarily in a monetary sense, but just in terms of being kind to people, because you know what, it's the littlest things that can, you know, can change a person's mood, and just that somebody's acknowledging them in a weird way. It's completely shaped me, and my relationship with my father has completely shaped the way that I was, you know, my relationship with men, but it made me a much stronger person in a lot of ways, but I never dealt with it in therapy because I was too busy dealing with my marriages and with my eating. And it's just now that it's sort of surfacing, which is very strange for being 53. And now that I'm kind of like, you know, I got to figure this out, but I think it's just, you know, it's, people say that like if you have two or three really, really good friends, you're rich. You know, that's all you need. You know, I don't need to win a popularity contest. Like I have people that I have shared this with that I know I can call if I'm in crisis. And I suffer from a mild depressive disorder, which I think is also, nature versus nurture kind of thing. You know, I think it's a lot of it is circumstantial, but I think that it was going to happen anyway. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but that might, I mean, I just go on and, I don't have a choice. I have children, you know, and believe me, there are days when I don't want to go on, but I have responsibilities that are bigger than me and bigger than these other challenges that I've had to face. And just so you know, as you were saying that, it makes me so sad that my dad especially never met Charlotte, but he would have been in his 90s.
Yeah,
so he's
older.
They were older.
Yeah.
But I think it you know, everybody listening, or at least most people listening, have had that experience with some grandparent or some member in your family that you're really close with. And it was hard because separate from the fact of like how he died, like I lost someone that I think would have been like a really big part of my life. Sorry. And I almost like feel bad saying that because like when people talk about losing grandparents, I'm kind of like, I kind of roll my eyes because it's like, you know, people lose parents, they lose kids, and it's like everybody loses their grandparents.
Right.
But for me, it I felt it, even like being a kid, feeling like someone was taken from you too soon. And like, I think it's taken me a long time to deal with it too, because the way that I deal with it is that like, it scares me. Like it not that I think I'm in danger or that you're in danger, but it makes the world feel dangerous. Like, how can this happen to someone who seemingly, not that it should happen to anyone, but to someone who seemingly was like pretty much minding his business. And I think it's, you know, even though my mom and we didn't get into all this, I don't really want to, but like any mother and daughter, any parent and kid, you and I haven't always seen eye to eye on every single thing. And I think a lot of what you deal with food or with your anxiety, I deal with too. And as people know, when you see yourself in your parent, it can be hard because I love you so much and you love me so much that I think, I had a point, and my point was, and I talk about this a lot in therapy, is that we have both had these experiences that are so unspeakable. Like, I feel like I've lived this experience through you. And one of the best qualities that you have, it had to happen in a very unfortunate way, is that you, anytime there's something bad that happens, like I remember when I was at Penn and there was a boy in my grade, my peer, he wasn't a friend, but he killed himself. I called you, and I would call you anyway, cause you're my mom. But like, my mom really knows how to just like handle these situations. Not that you needed to do anything, but it's like, there's no like air of anything. Like if something horrible happened to me or my friend, I would be like, you should call my mom, because my mom has like seen really, really terrible things. I call you the trauma whisperer to my friends. Cause you just, I mean, it's not good, but it's like the fact that this happened with your brother and this happened with your dad, and there was never any closure. You know, you're the person that people can call. And I think that speaks a lot to life generally, which is like, you know, whether you think things happen for a reason or not, I don't know. But when you go through these terrible things, it makes you like this unbelievably,
resilient
person. And like, I almost want to say like resourceful. Like you really, yes, you really know how to like
help others,
how to help other people.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, I'd like to think that, well, I'm a survivor. I don't like, I'm a survivor. And I just know, it's just the irony of it is that as the years have passed, I have met so many people. I have one of Charlotte's friends, I'd mentioned it to you. Her grandfather, who was already a grown man married with kids, killed himself, and she's been very vocal about it. I mean, you wouldn't believe like the bad crap that has happened to,
I think,
so many people,
and they, right,
and they don't talk about it. You know,
And I'm not going to say anything specific, but I remember telling you this story, mm-hmm, and you then reflecting to me like things that have happened in your family. And I was like, oh, like it really, it can feel very isolating when you tell the story to someone, because, mm-hmm, it's like, how could anyone like have a story, right, like this? But they do. Like, it might not have been someone getting murdered, God forbid, but
yeah,
every family has like really weird and messy and scary stuff that happens. And I'm very thankful that we're able to talk about it, because I think a lot of people, even like with your parents, when your brother died, kind of were like, they just swept it under the rug, and it made everything worse. It maybe would have made it temporary. Like, I think what people fear is talking about it, because that feels worse in the moment, but in the long term, it's like a disease. Like it's like cancer. It starts to grow inside of you. And the longer you go without talking about it, the worse it gets. And it's such an opportunity for people to help others. Like, you, mm-hmm, you have kind of used this experience as you open your doors to other people. I remember you had a colleague, mom, who I think she had lost her brother to like, he had, somebody killed him. I don't know if you remember that, when you worked at Penn, and I remember you saying she talked to me and I gave her this book about like dealing with violent death. And I always remembered that because that's so you, like someone having this issue and you were just like, you make yourself available. There's no, you, nothing makes you flinch is what I'm trying to say. I could come with you and say, I know someone who they know someone who they died in a murder suicide, like all this crazy stuff. And you don't flinch because you're like, yeah, life is like that sometimes, unfortunately. You're a little bit of a lightning rod in some ways, Mom. I don't know if you've ever realized that about yourself. Ooh, you.
Why?
Well, you said like I'm a survivor and I'm the person who lives to tell all these things, but I have always took note of how it seems like maybe more bad things or more evidently bad things have happened to you and your family than most other people I know.
Yeah, my family's pretty screwed up. I mean, you know, my father's family especially. I mean,
I want to ask you a final question, Mom. And my final question is, it's a loaded one, but how do you, you know, what keeps you going besides like, I have kids. Okay. But like, which is important, but like what keeps you having a sense of purpose when you feel down or, and if you say, you know, I have trouble finding a sense of purpose, that's also an appropriate answer, but I'm curious how you wake up in the morning and especially, you know, in the years that followed Pop-Up's death, what did you tell yourself? Like, what did you do? How did you find any sense of happiness or peace again, if you found it?
I self-medicated a lot, honestly. After my father died, I mean, I didn't treat myself very well. And it was not a healthy lifestyle, put it that way. And I just kind of, I don't know. I have right now, I have the love of a wonderful man who allows me, I told Lizzie this, allows me the freedom to talk about this. It's kind of just get over it kind of thing, you know, has had his own stuff, but it's like, he thinks it's a remarkable thing that I have just survived, you know, and I've maintained relationships and friendships. But I think that the healthiest thing for people to do is to find somebody to talk to, is to seek professional help. I can't, and you guys talk about it all the time, but I'm a firm believer in finding somebody who you can trust to work through these things with. And, you know, I don't believe that everything happens for a reason. I think some things do, but, you know, it's really true. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I do believe that. And I've been lucky. There's no other way to put it. I've been lucky. And I feel very blessed because, you know what? I know that there are really people who have it a lot worse than I do.
And that's incredible to hear you say, because, you know, someone would probably listen and say she's had it really tough, but to be able to say that you're blessed is an amazing outlook. And
well, I feel that way today. Ask me tomorrow.
No, I mean, it's a day by day thing. Like, no one wakes up every single day and is like, wow, I'm so lucky. Like, I have the best life ever.
Totally.
But it is an amazing outlook, and it's an amazing, it's great to see like how far you've come, given everything that happened.
Well, that's what people have to remember that have had experienced any kind of real trauma, is that, you know what, you have to find a way to work through it and find some sort of conduit, whether it's professional help, which it should be. but always keep in mind, somebody's got it worse, you know? And as my Marine fiance says to me, hey, listen, nobody's shooting at you, you know?
Really? I know that you said final question, but you know what is mind-boggling to me is that the therapist that you were seeing hadn't explored your past until recently.
They didn't ask you about Pop-Up?
No, I think I pretty much stopped going at that point. I couldn't handle it. Like, there was too much for me. I couldn't handle it. It was just, that to me was too overwhelming. And I mean, I need to start seeing somebody again, but I have to find the right person.
I think my question came from, because you had said that there were other things you were working on in therapy, such as your relationships and your eating issues, that you weren't addressing what was happening or what had happened to you in the past. And I'm trying to envision a scenario where you're going to therapy and they're not asking you about that trauma.
I think I had stopped therapy that time. I wasn't going that often. And I couldn't delve into it. It was, just too painful. And I don't know why something triggered me. At this point in my life where I said, you know what, I can't leave this earth and not talk about it and, you know, scream it at the top of my lungs and you know, yeah. It's part of me, you know, part of me. And I'm not going to let, you know, him, you know, he was a great dad. He was a fabulous dad. And, you know, he did some kind of crappy things towards the end, but I can't let just a few acts define mm-hmm. who he was. Same person who taught me how to ride a bicycle, right. You know, I can't imagine my parents like, and just as part of it, I can't imagine my parents like going to the park and pushing my brother, you know, in a swing, and then 21, right. He's gone. And, you know, I couldn't go on. I don't know how my parents, well, I think they had to because of me, but it was just like, nothing was.
And just to clarify, when you said he did a couple crappy things, because our list, like we told our listeners that he was, this had nothing to do with work. Like you're referring to your relationship strain that you had
yeah.
after you got divorced. Like he wasn't doing crappy things to people or with his job. Just like your relationship had a strain.
She said, no, to me.
No, I'm just trying to clarify because we were like, he was clean. He was safe.
Yeah.
He wasn't doing like crappy things that someone would be like, no, he should go to jail. No, he was like, the relationship had a strain based on your divorce. If that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think probably a lot of built up just anger, you know, being somewhat psychologically aware, just because of what had happened to my brother. I just think I got the brunt of it.
Okay, mommy.
Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm sure it's not easy, but I'm glad that you're at a place where you want to talk about it because
I told Lizzie that I really, really wanted to come on the show and like talk about this and like, you know, but there had obviously for you guys, there had to be like, not just the tragic aspects of it, but like, what's the resolution? Because that's what the whole show is about. It's like, how do you kind of work towards a goal mm-hmm. of fixing things? And it just meant a lot to me that, you know, you were willing to, you know, have me as a guest. So, well, I figured, you know, if you had Charlotte on, you might as well have my mother. And
no, we're honored to have you on. Like this is Liz and I were talking about having you on. And I think we were saying like, well, when are you going to be in New York? But with COVID, it's really difficult. And it was kind of just like, let's just do a Zoom online thing because your story is really important to share. And it's also, I think it'll help people understand maybe Liz a little bit better.
Yeah.
And it's always important for people to hear other people's stories and understand that you can go through like the toughest trauma and still come out of it on the other side. Like you're a great example, I think. Yeah.
Thank you. Life is a journey. I mean, you kind of got to go with it. And I do think it helps explain a lot about who mm-hmm. my daughter is. Oh, both of them. And the little one doesn't even know it yet. So, but I mean, you've met her. So you can understand.
I met her twice and I was obsessed with her. I am obsessed with her. Hi, Charlotte.
Yep. I'll send her there for a week or two. So you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. And Sarah, you're so lovely. I don't know why she keeps.
Yeah, I don't know either.
We're in a panorama.
We're in a Panera.
I know. Almost a year.
No,
you
can't believe it.
No, we have a 13-year-old, you know, learning virtually.
I know,
it's fun.
I can't imagine.
Okay, mommy.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And I hope we get to meet in person soon.
We will. We will definitely.
Love you.
Love you, Elizabeth.
Bye.
Bye.
So that was the episode with my mom. I hope everyone, again, don't want to say enjoyed, but I hope everyone took away something like positive from it. You know, she has a lot of hope and strength.
Yeah, definitely. I think that we can all learn something from her in the way that she living her life now with these just like a positive attitude. I mean, just to hear your mom say, I feel so blessed. I feel so lucky mm-hmm. Because others have it worse. It's just like an unbelievable mindset. And
she's also, she says like, I feel that way today, but ask me tomorrow. Like, I think my mom is really realistic about how hard her life has been, which I appreciate because I'm glad she didn't come on the podcast and say like, well, it's all been rosy ever since.
Right.
Obviously, it wouldn't be for anyone. So I just hope everyone can sort of feel like if you go through something terrible in your life whether it's losing someone or losing someone in a really like violent way, or you know, that there's life on the other side. Mm-hmm. And I am really appreciative that everyone took the time to listen. It's my story and my mom's story, and I'm glad you all listened.
Yeah. And as usual, we know this was a really heavy one, so if you need resources, like, we will provide.
Yeah.
We're here to, our DMs are open. Mm-hmm. Whatever you need. Like, I know this was tough, so.
Definitely. So as usual, you can find us on Instagram at It's Fine I'm Fine Pod. You can follow me there at Liz Height. You can also follow us on Twitter and TikTok. Oh, no, Twitter at It's Fine I'm Fine PD. TikTok, It's Fine I'm Fine Pod. How about you, Sarah? Where can people find you?
You can follow me at Sarah L. Sassone. That's N like Nancy. On Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Hope you have a nice week.
Hope you have a great week.
And with that, it's fine. I'm fine.
It's fine. I'm fine.